This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of the World Wide Wave on joy.org.au.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the World Wide Wave.
It's the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
It is, and thanks very much to the gang from Generation Next for another amazing show. So tonight you have Matt and myself, Chris, and we are taking you around the world. And tonight we are stopping off in Africa, in fact, the Horn of Africa, to be precise. And we want to know, how does the forced migration affect the sexual practices of refugees? What happens when asylum seekers are resettled in Australia? And what do the sexual cultures of Australian men and men in the Horn of Africa region have in common? To understand gay life and sexuality in the Horn of Africa, tonight we speak with Samuel Muchoki. He is from the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society at La Trobe University and is doing a doctoral research project on migration, sexuality and sexual health, exploring the experiences of Horn of Africa men with refugee backgrounds. So tonight we are in the Horn of Africa, but we have to ask you first, Samuel, where is the Horn of Africa? Which countries does it comprise of?
Thank you. Well, the Horn of Africa comprises of many countries, and it's also dependent on who is talking on what it means to be the Horn of Africa. Mm. So, for example, in my research, the Horn of Africa contexted four countries, that is Sudan, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Somalia. But actually, you find in literature some people will classify Djibouti, Kenya as the Horn of Africa. But for the purpose of my research, I use these four countries to refer to the Horn of Africa.
And for the geographically redundant among us, the Horn of Africa is in the northeast. Is that what we'd call it?
It's the pointy bit off the side, isn't it? Hence the horn.
Yes, on the eastern coast.
It's the horn. Yes. Actually, when you look at the map of Africa, you see the horn where the horn is. So Somalia is all, it's there, and the surrounding countries.
Fantastic.
And that one region is home to 100 million people.
Wow, I had no idea it was so many.
Yeah. Amazing, particularly Ethiopia, the largest by far, 85 million in the area.
So we've got quite a few countries to cover tonight in our fun fast facts. In Eritrea, both male and female same-sex sexual activity is illegal. It is prohibited under a penal code from 1957 and is, of course, part of a colonial legacy, as we learn every week.
Where it's called unnatural carnal offences.
Which sounds rather delicious,
actually. And there's pretty much no real benefits for same-sex relations in the area. No legal recognition, no adoption, no protections against discrimination or sexual orientation. In fact, the UN High Commission for Refugees stated that there are strong societal taboos against homosexuality, just not spoken about.
Indeed, and we can see that travelling through to laws in Ethiopia and South Sudan as well. So in Ethiopia, homosexual acts are never considered a victimless crime under the law, which is very interesting. I think that's something that's quite unique for Ethiopia. Certainly, it's not something I've come across before.
In fact, the aggressor is actually, you know, considered worse in the sexual aggressor, the person who's on top, I guess, is considered the worse one, if you like.
Hmm. And I think the penalties must reflect that as well. And then in South Sudan, homosexual activity is, of course, illegal as well. And the sentence at the moment is 10 years imprisonment. So not great news coming out of this region for same-sex sexual activity.
And that also has an impact on HIV and AIDS prevention. So the, I guess, the ability for people to speak up, there's quite a few social taboos about HIV, and it's very difficult for international organisations. In fact, it's only the international organisations who are in there and able to actually help out in the delivery of services. There is one bright spot, though.
There is.
And I know, Samuel, it's not a part of your area of study, but Djibouti, same-sex sexual activity is actually legal. They just forgot to make it illegal, but it's legal.
Do you know what? Would there be a reason for that? Is it just something, an oversight, do you think? I don't know.
Actually, I'm not sure. I should maybe research more.
That's your next research project,
perhaps that's my next research.
And how we can spread that goodwill around, hopefully.
This is Nikki from Canada, where everybody can get married.
Welcome.
Listen to the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Welcome to the World Wide Wave, where tonight we are in the Horn of Africa, and we are lucky enough to be speaking with Samuel Muchoki from the Australian Research Centre in Sex Health and Society, which is at La Trobe. And he has just finished his PhD. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Looking at the Horn of Africa men with refugee backgrounds and what that means in terms of sexuality and sexual health. So it sounds like a pretty big research topic that you've taken on here. Where did you even start with this research?
Well, when I moved to Australia and I started my PhD, I started thinking of the research topic that I wanted to explore or investigate. And one of the things that I came across when I was doing the literature review is finding, the Horn of Africa men are newly arrived migrants in Australia. And I also wanted to understand what are the sexuality challenges, if you may will, that they face when they are navigating, life in Australia.
Did you find that the candidates that you studied, the participants in your research, did they identify in terms of sexuality in the same way that we would understand sexuality in Australia? So in terms of both sexual preference and also, I suppose, you mentioned that gender came up quite a lot.
Yes. Now, my participant, well, what I did in the research, I wanted to explore everything about, sexuality and gender also comes in when you're talking about, sexual practices, when you talk about sexual health. So they really talked about so many things, but one of the things I wanted to understand is their sexual practices and perhaps whether that has changed when they moved to Australia. So they didn't really use sexual identity to talk about their experiences, but they will talk about their practices in general.
Is it in moving and being relocated? Because a lot of these people are actually being relocated, they're escaping a problem. Is that sort of just something that is not on their mind? There's so many other bigger issues on their mind than sexuality?
Well, that's the thing, and especially when they move or they settle in Australia, they are also faced with host of many challenges, settlement challenges, housing, employment, and so sexuality really doesn't come up in their mind. And that's why I wanted to explore sexual health. When you move to this country and the things you're thinking about, employment and your, how you're going to settle in Australia, where does sexuality come in? How does that impact on your sexual practices? So I really wanted to bring that in their mind so that they will discuss and tell me how really they have negotiated life here.
And what did you find? Are people's sexual practices different in a different environment? Is it something that people just aren't thinking about or aren't engaging in because they've got too many other things in their mind?
Yes, it's at the back of their mind, really, because there are so many things that are happening. If you think about these men, they have a refugee background, so they didn't make have a choice. They did not decide that they want to come and settle in Australia compared with, for example, skilled migrants. So to them, really thinking about sexuality or everyday life that any other migrants think about was at the back of their mind. So they are dealing with so many other issues. For example, even language. Some of them did not understand, English, how to speak English. So there's quite a lot of challenges that they are facing. So sexual practices is at the back of their mind.
And you mentioned language. That's a very interesting one. How did you communicate with all of your subjects who come from such a range of countries?
Yes. Now, what I did, and that's a limitation of my study, is I used English as a medium of, communication, because many of them are coming from all these many, they have a, diverse background and they have their first language. And so I thought the way to go around that is to talk about, is to use English as the medium of communication. But one of the things that I realized at the end of it all is when you are talking about sexuality, it's a sensitive topic. So many of them actually were happy to talk about their sexual practices or their sexuality because English was their you know, another language that was their second or their third language. And so they were a bit comfortable to talk about sexual practices, to talk about having sex, to talk about diverse sexual practices, because their first language actually is a taboo. If you think about, I use my example, English is my third language, but to talk about, you know, having sex in my first language is a taboo.
It's a kind of freedom almost that you can express something?
It goes back to how you've been brought up and what you really think is, you know, it's a taboo or not. So for them, using English as a medium of communication was actually good, because they felt that they would be able to explore and express their ideas.
And when you say it's a taboo, does that mean that people may not even have the vocabulary to speak about sex? Or is it that they know the words in their first language, but it just feels too wrong to say them because of that ingrained taboo?
It is both. First of all, in terms of using the same, you know, using the words to talk about maybe a sexual act. And the second thing is really they don't have the vocabulary. For example, think about oral sex. You know, what is that in their first language? And when they don't have the words, but at least they moved to Australia and they picked, you know, some of
them.
They
picked up those words pretty quick.
Those words, and they would express, you know, they would use those words to express their sexual practices.
I'm interested because you said that they are the participants were quite happy to speak about their sexuality and their sexual experiences. That's the in Australia, that's the exact opposite to being at home, though, isn't it? So, did they sort of feel this sense of release in being able to speak about it?
I think the fact that I use English was helped them. But also the other thing that I've explored in my PhD, I really wanted to understand my positionality in research. So if I was doing this study, you know, back in their country, how would they respond to that? So perhaps it could be because of the environment. Some of them would feel it was easier for them to talk about their experiences in this context.
What was the biggest learning that, or the biggest commonality from all your research participants that you found?
There was quite a lot that they, you know, they talked about. For example, you know, new sexual practices, learning new sexual practices, engaging in interracial relations. Mm-hmm. In Australia, learning new things, including, for example, I know a couple of men told me they learned how to use condom from their sexual partners,
right.
Because that was not an issue. You know, at home, you really don't talk about, you know, use of condom. Of course, you understand they are coming from ravaged, you know, the countries are ravaged by war. So even having an opportunity to study, you know, to have sexual education, not many of them had that experience or that background.
Hi, my name is Kenneth. I'm from LGB Denmark. You're hearing me on the World Wide Wave.
Tonight we are in the Horn of Africa speaking to Samuel Muchoki.
Now, Samuel, we were talking a little earlier. You made mention of interracial relationships. So for somebody who, a refugee who has come to Australia, as a refugee, and they've met an Aussie, how do interracial relationships, from their experiences, how are they coming about?
Some of them had interesting stories about interracial relationships, and particularly I remember two of the men mentioned to me that before, you know, within the first 2 months in Australia, they had already engaged in sexual relations with an Australian sexual partner. One of them actually did not even know how to speak in English. But some of them would talk about some of the things that they have learned from their Australian sexual partners.
What could they possibly learn from Aussie guys?
New sexual practices, you know, for example, oral sex, anal sex. They would talk about, you know, they feel they are free to explore their sexuality compared with having a sexual relation with somebody from their community. And I guess it's because of the, you know, if you are you're having a sexual partner from your community, there are these cultural taboos, or the expectations that you're supposed to meet when you're engaging somebody from your community. And I guess for them, the fact that they have Australian sexual partners, then the issue of culture or the norms, cultural taboos, flies out of the window.
So you said that something like oral sex, they're learning this. Is it that at home they didn't have the chance to explore because of those societal taboos, or is oral sex just not common?
Now, those I talked to from my research, they said they had never done such a thing at home. So they learned those sexual, well, they felt that, you know, they participated in those sexual practices when they moved to Australia.
It's quite an education.
It is indeed. And you said that some people who came to Australia and were married already would have still had some of those cultural taboos in place. So when you had conversations with people who were married, what was the situation for them exploring sexuality in Australia?
I think, to some of them, and really I'm not generalizing because this was a qualitative study. So you look at a case-to-case basis, but at least you can draw some of the meaning, some of the experiences, and use that to extrapolate and talk about the situations of the people who are migrating from the Horn of Africa. Especially those who are married, you find some of them were really finding it difficult, especially relating with their wives.
So their wives came out with them?
Yes, they moved with their wives. And there was this general perception that in Australia, the women having more power, so they can really not, the men cannot subject the women to their will.
What gives the women more power?
Well, a number of things. First of all, the laws in this country. For example, these laws against domestic violence. Mm-hmm. There are intervention orders in this country. And that's something new from where they have come from. If you have a problem in the Horn of Africa with the women, with your wife, it's your wife who leaves the family house. But in this country, actually, some of the men discovered that you can be given intervention order and you're told to leave the family house, and you may end up also losing your kids, and then you have to pay child support.
Wow. I had never even thought of that.
But in the Horn of Africa, the kids belong to the man.
Is it from the interviews that you conducted,
yep,
do these men who have sex with men, are they staying with their wife? Are they living two lives here in Australia?
Now, all the men in my study identified as heterosexuals. That is, they were having relations with women. But there were instances of some men who talked about same-sex activities, but they would not say that, you know,
they're not gay.
They are not, yeah.
They might have sex with a man, but they're not gay.
They're having sexual relations. They're having sexual activities. For example, you know, I remember one of them talking about, you know, touching each other on the genitals and all that. But when you asked about same-sex relation, they will say, well, I'm not gay.
Is that, do you think, something because they are new, or it's just so culturally ingrained that there's no possibility that they will ever have a realization about sexuality?
Well, I think gay as an identity is a Western concept, so you'll find that there are in Africa there are same sex relations happening, but people will not identify as gay or as lesbians. You know, so the fact that they would, well, having same-sex relations does not really define their identity. It's something that, you know, would come up. I remember asking one of them about, you know, same-sex relations back home. I would say, you know, you'll be killed if you are discovered that you're having same-sex relations. And actually, he narrated to me a story of his cousin who had sex a sexual relation with another man, and that man actually, when, you know, ended up killing him because he felt it was against the culture.
Wow. Mm. That concept of, I mean, when societal pressures can go that far as to incite murder, that's pretty scary. Does that make Australia a bit of a relief, as much as there's those changes in the laws or the shift of power because of the laws that, you know, enable women or protect women? Is that also, therefore, a bit of a safeguard that won't happen to you, therefore it's okay to go out and explore your sexuality here?
Partly it is, but also... the other thing is, with these men, they are also having connections with where they have come from. So when you think about your, they think about their sexuality, it's not only their sexuality, but also it affects their families, their communities. Particularly for example, for those who are having interracial relations, they were finding it very difficult to have their partners accepted by the family. Not only in Australia, but also overseas. So when you think about sexuality, you know, some of them would engage in sexual practices secretly because they don't want to be discovered that this is what is happening in their lives. So partly, I think it enables some men to embrace their sexuality in Australia because of the environment, but also... to navigate the cultural issue and also the collectivist culture is still a big challenge.
And did you find that people's perceptions of HIV and the risks of HIV changed very much by the time they came to Australia?
Well, many of my participants really thought that Australia is free of HIV. Because in Africa, there's a lot of messages about, you know, HIV. Every time you think about sex, you think about HIV. But they moved to this country. They went through, you know,
the medical requirements.
Yeah, the medical requirements. Yep. And then they settle in this country. And they think, well, you never hear about HIV. There are no messages targeting Horn of Africa or even Sub-Saharan Africa. And so there was the perception that there's no HIV in Australia. Mm. And so quite a number of them engage in risky sexual practices without really thinking about use of condom or safe sex.
Were there ways for people to discover that HIV is actually still a risk within Australian communities? Or was your conversation with them the first time that they'd realised?
Yes, it was the first time that they realised. Some of them also, well, two of my participants will say, well, there's nothing like HIV. You know, there's nothing like HIV in this country. And as much as you really want to explore with them, they have been in this country for 4 or 5 years, but they really believe that there's no HIV in this country. So they will engage in sexual practices here. But when they go overseas, some of them would use safe sex, they will use condom in their sexual practices, but they move here, they'll not think about use of condom.
In fact, you even mentioned there was one participant who had not used a condom before until they met an Australian?
Yes, two of them actually.
Two?
They were taught how to use condom by their Australian partners.
Do you have, from your studies, do you have a takeout on that? What needs to, is there anything that can be done to help in that education process for a refugee, a forced migrant that comes to Australia?
Yes, a lot needs to happen, particularly in order to address, first of all, the issue that, you know, there's no HIV in Australia. A lot of education needs to happen. As I said before, you go to Africa and the Horn of Africa, and there are many programs on, you know, safe sex, about sexuality. Unfortunately, the way sexuality has been presented in Africa, it's about, you know, risky sexual practices. There's no pleasure. You never hear about, you know, pleasurable sexual relationship in Africa. All of it is kind of, much of it is around HIV. and then you move to this country, they don't have programs. You never hear about, HIV and AIDS. So I think there's a lot that needs to be done in promoting healthy relationships and also informing the migrants about HIV, about sexual practices, but also about pleasurable sexual practices, embracing sexuality in this country.
About having fun. Now, we've had a question in from Daniel. Thanks, Daniel. Samuel, in your research, what would you say about the general perspective and attitudes on same-sex amongst the youth of Africa?
I think I'll answer that question from the finding from my research. Generally, there is negative attitude about same-sex relations, but also that's coming from the cultural perspective and the issue about gay, lesbian. But when you talk to people, they'll really acknowledge there's some sexual practices.
Do you have any sense of generational change, any positives on the horizon from the next generation?
Yes. I talked to the participants in my focus group discussion would say that, there are these things that, especially for the young people, they are accepting and they are embracing and saying, well, this is a right for somebody to embrace their sexuality. And that was different from the older people that I interviewed. They were very... they were against same-sex relations, but when the young people that I talked to are really, coming up to embrace that.
Samuel, thank you very much for joining us here in the studio and sharing with us your studies. And congratulations on your... Can we call you doctor yet?
Doctor? Until I graduate.
Not okay. Quite.
Almost doctor.
Thanks for joining us on the World Wide Wave.
Thank you very much.
Hola, mi nombre es Félix de Colombia. You are on World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to the World Wide Wave, where tonight we have been in the Horn of Africa. It's time for a bit of worldwide rap, and the first one up is local news. It's from Australia.
Opera, local news that went worldwide, by the way.
Local news that did go worldwide, because Opera Australia took a very positive stance and has... taken off their contract, soprano Tamar Iveri, who made some really terrible comments online supporting the way that the Georgian president and Christian Orthodox groups have treated some members of the gay pride parade in Georgia. So she wrote, "I was quite proud of the fact how Georgian society spat at the parade. Please stop vigorous attempts to bring the West's fecal masses in the mentality of the people by means of propaganda." And Opera Australia came back and announced that they had released her from their contract and said that Opera Australia believes that the views of Tamar are unconscionable. So this is a very strong stance from them and I think a very positive step in the right direction.
And a message to others. I would have thought, though, I mean, the arts is loaded with gay and lesbian people.
Well, particularly in Melbourne as well.
But I tell you, it does surprise me when somebody of such a profile within the arts community comes out with a statement like that.
Well, yeah, exactly. Within Sydney and Opera Australia, it wasn't the best idea to start off with.
No. Now across to the UK, where the first gay British clergyman has had his permission to lead some services revoked.
Boo.
Boo. Canon Jeremy Pemberton. He has married his long-term partner in April in defiance of the Church of England guidance that the bishops put on them. And he has now confirmed that he is no longer allowed to operate as a priest in his shire. The diocese official said clergy must model the church's teachings.
Very questionable. In other news, over to Russia, which we haven't visited in a few weeks, very surprising for this show, where unfortunately directors of an LGBT film, which is called Children 404, and it's a documentary about the lives of a group of LGBT teens in Russia. So the directors of this documentary have been summoned for questioning at Moscow's prosecutor's office because the film has fallen under the awareness of Russian officials, particularly after, of course, the gay propaganda laws that have come through in that country. So people came out to picket the first screening, always a good sign, claiming it promoted a homosexual lifestyle. I'm actually astonished that it got to screens at all.
Indeed.
I suppose that's quite a broad thing. And yes, so people have been called to be prosecuted, unfortunately.
There was some other news out of Russia, actually, from St. Petersburg, where they actually revoked the anti-gay propaganda laws. Now, that sounds really exciting, But the reason they revoked those anti-gay propaganda laws was because the national laws were in place and they didn't think they were necessary. Sorry about that. I was excited for all of half a second.
I was smiling for just a moment.
Some good news from Mongolia, though, and we have spoken to Otto from Mongolia. You can see that, listen to that podcast on our website, which is joy.org.au/worldwidewave. Mongolia has brought in laws to protect LGBTI people from hate crimes. This is something that Otto's group has been working on.
It is, and Mongolia, sandwiched in between Russia and China, you'd think the situation wouldn't be too bright, but instead they seem to be a real bright spot in this region, doing all kinds of wonderful things. There are PFLAG groups, there's a queer film festival. It's a really, really active member of the LGBTI community, I guess, in this region, so that's really wonderful news. A little bit of worrying news from Austria. So we have spoken a couple of times now with an MP from Austria called Ulrike Lunacek. You'll actually hear Ulrike's voice on some of our introductions
into
World Wide Wave. I've
programmed it coming up.
Exactly. So listen up and you hear Ulrike next. Unfortunately, at Vienna Pride, there was an attack against Ulrike. There was an attack where butyric acid was thrown.
It's like a smelling gas.
It's a smelling gas. It's terrible, but not as bad as it sounds. Was thrown towards the parade. Thankfully, no one was hurt, and the man who did it hasn't been found.
That brings us to the end of our worldwide wrap for this week.
This is Ulrike Lunacek, member of the European Parliament and co-president of the Parliament's LGBT intergroup on the World Wide Wave.
And thank you so much for Samuel Muchoki from La Trobe University for joining us tonight and speaking about his research. Thanks very much also to Matthew, Steph, Angel, Joe and Belinda, who've interacted with us this week on our Facebook.
To Eamon on the front desk, and a big, huge thank you and hugs and kisses galore to Christine, because Christine's leaving us for a while.
Not
to
willingly.
Go overseas.
Heading to Mozambique to work with an LGBT group, so hopefully I'll be speaking to World Wide Wave very soon.
Which is just fantastic. We will give you a call in Mozambique and find out what it's like there. You've been listening to the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Thank you for listening to the World Wide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.